Don't be surprised by the latest changes to your commute. Get traffic and weather together every 10 minutes on the 8s on 103.5 FM, WTOP Radio. Now back on 107.7 FM.
Football's back at RFK Stadium with the Military Bowl, presented by Northrop Grumman. It's hometown Maryland versus East Carolina on December 29th. Two of the nation's high-powered offenses match up, all for the benefit of the USO. Don't miss this explosive college football action at RFK as D.C. hosts East Carolina and Maryland December 29th. Tickets on sale now at all Ticketmaster locations or visit militarybowl.org.
Have you delayed putting together an estate plan? Your retirement savings, insurance policies, and real estate are all part of your assets. If you or your partner should ever become incapacitated, who will handle the financial or medical decisions? And how do you want those assets distributed? Hi, I'm Wayne Zell of Zell Law and host of Blueprint for Wealth Saturdays at 10 a.m. Find out how you can better secure your future this Saturday or call me at Zell Law at 571-203-9355. Or visit us on the web at zelllaw.com.
The FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com takes a look at the issues surrounding cloud computing through the eyes of those who are using it every day. We'll share with you the challenges, opportunities, and lessons learned from some of the top minds in the world of federal IT. Collaborate with others and help shape the discussion on cloud computing at the FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com or follow the FedCloud blog on Twitter. The FedCloud blog is sponsored by Cisco and Intel.
Tune in to Fed Central, dedicated to sharing insights and best practices on topics ranging from cybersecurity to sustainability to healthcare reform. Hear straight talk from government leaders and industry specialists on the issues that are shaping how agencies serve their mission and their constituents. Hosted by veteran broadcaster Jane Norris, don't miss Fed Central on the third and fourth Wednesday of the month at 1 p.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Sponsored by Deloitte.
Ugh, would you look at this bill?
Tired of paying way too much to your alarm company and not getting real security service? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems and pay just $18.95 a month, and there's no cost to switch. Why Ackerman? Ackerman has more than 40 years of industry-leading experience and was recently named Dealer of the Year out of over 30,000 companies. Ackerman has its own UL and CSAA 5 Diamond Certified Monitoring Center. Put simply, with Ackerman Security Systems, you get the most qualified professionals in the industry monitoring your home for just $18.95 a month. Over 180,000 people enjoy peace of mind with Ackerman. So whether you want a new system or want to switch to reliable monitoring for just $18.95 a month, call 888-999-1070, 888-999-1070, or visit AckermanSecurity.com. Federal employees call today and get 4 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service.
Hey there, I'm Christopher Dorabeck. Here's what we're working on for the Dorabeck Insider this afternoon. Old Man Winter barely arrived. Snowmageddon still very much in our memory. What are OPM's plans for dealing with this winter? We'll find out. And recovery.gov, a real leader in 2010. Transparency, cloud computing, open data. We're going to tap lessons learned with Earl Devaney of the Recovery and Transparency Board this afternoon, 3 to 7, on the Dorabeck Insider. It's right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
If you work for or have worked for the federal government, I want to tell you about an organization that's been around for over 80 years. It's NARF. Organized in 1921 to protect and enhance the retirement and health benefits of federal employees, NARF wants you to know that laws can change and so can your retirement security. Protect it by joining NARF, the only association that's dedicated to making sure your retirement is secure when you reach retirement. Don't wait until after you retire to join NARF. Check out their website at www.narfe.org. You'll see that NARF is a great investment for your retirement future. Then click on the Join Now button and join hundreds of thousands of federal retirees and employees as a NARF member. That's www.narfe.org. Or call 1-800-627-3394 and ask them to send you some information. Join now. NARF, your best retirement investment.
Hey, Eagles fans! Tickets to all American University men's and women's basketball home games in Bender Arena are on sale now. Get them online 24/7 at AUEagles.com or by calling the Athletics Ticket Office at 202-885-TIXX. That's 202-885-TIX. Make your plans now to be part of another historic season in Bender Arena.
Catch the Eagles' next home game Monday, January 3rd against Brown University at 7:30 p.m.
You hear the sounds of hammers and saws, but it's also the sound of freedom and independence. Across America, people are supporting Homes for Our Troops build specially adapted homes for our severely injured veterans. Now, it's your turn to help Sergeant Stephen Kiernan, who lost both legs while serving in Iraq. He volunteered to protect our freedom. You can volunteer your time, donate materials, or make a cash donation to this effort. Visit homesforourtroops.org or call 866-7-TROOPS.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
And now Ask the CIO, brought to you by Vion Corporation.
Susan Swart is the State Department's Chief Information Officer. She says state is piloting mobile devices with an eye on what their future environment could look like.
We could move potentially, not swiftly maybe, but longer term, couple of years, to device agnosticism, and that we would have more of a personal choice. I have this device. I like this device for a valid business reason. And we have a way to sandbox the State Department application securely.
CIOs and IT directors, are you paying for capacity services that you're not using? Take a good look at your capacity services contract, and next time, make sure you're not signing just another lease. Ask the experts. Vion Corporation, you can create a plan so that you only pay for what you use. When your job is on the line with data storage decisions, that's the way to go. With a 30-year partnership, Vion and Hitachi Data Systems have been bringing you innovative technologies with integrity and quality service. Visit Vion.com to learn more. That's Vion.com.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
Job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview, and I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
FLIR Systems has a singular focus on providing thermal imaging night vision systems for search and rescue, surveillance, and force protection across the globe. We proudly support the men and women who serve, defend, and protect by providing leading-edge technology to enhance mission success. Today, customers trust in FLIR Systems' thermal imaging products and rely on our responsive support worldwide. Visit FLIR.com/GS for more details. FLIR Systems, extraordinary vision for extraordinary heroes.
Courage. The true meaning of the word is often forgotten. The Washington Capitals want to remind everyone what true courage is. Through Courage Caps, the Capitals will raise funds to help the truly courageous men and women who defend our country and their families. The Capitals are selling Courage Caps and T-shirts, with all proceeds benefiting our military kids, an organization that's dedicated to supporting National Guard and military reserve families, one child at a time. Join the Capitals and show your courage by purchasing a Courage Cap at WashingtonCaps.com today.
As government and commercial companies continue to improve their business processes, they're finding that IT requirement analysis, market reviews, product selection, and ongoing operations are taxing the resource base of their employees. TMR is here to help. TMR provides enterprise architecture, governance, and IT operational support to ensure our customers' IT investments are aligned with specific business goals, objectives, and capital investment strategies. For more details, visit TMR at tmrhq.com or call 703-323-1700.
Connect with Federal News Radio wherever you are. Like us on Facebook to see the hottest news stories on your wall. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio. Download our free iPhone app. Just go to the App Store and search for Federal News Radio. And now, connect to the radio station straight from your cell phone. Just call 712-432-6616. Go to federalnewsradio.com and search for social media for details.
Are you a bookkeeper, accounting assistant, accounting technician, or budget assistant looking for career advancement? Apply today for the Graduate School's new Associate of Applied Science in Accounting degree. You'll be prepared for a career in budget analysis, for government accounting positions above the GS-5 level, and for IRS accounting positions. Apply today. Classes start January 24th. Call an enrollment advisor at 202-314-3643. That's 202-314-3643. Or go to graduateschool.edu.
What is the information technology strategy for the U.S. General Services Administration? How is GSA modernizing its IT infrastructure and ensuring IT investments align with its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan next week as he explores these and other questions with his very special guest, Casey Coleman, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. General Services Administration. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Claudia Williams from the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology commented during the panel discussion titled Realizing the Promise of Health Information Exchange. Have we turned the corner?
What's exciting to me about ACOs and medical homes is the opportunity to create specific responsibility around care coordination and around specific jobs and tasks that I need to do to share it, to make sure the next person and the patient is engaged and knows what they're doing, and to have a way to measure our outcomes.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com. Keyword Booz Allen. How Health Information Exchange will facilitate individual mission priorities while advancing a common vision of a unified health system is a constant demand. Booz Allen Hamilton Strategy and Technology Consultants provide diverse perspectives from across the health market to place core issues such as privacy, security, and trust in the right context to help you make informed decisions, make Health Information Exchange possible, and improve the health and wellness of our nation. Count on Booz Allen to help you be ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
Listen to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM every Friday morning at 11 AM. Brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Fed Talk features live interviews with guests from the federal community sharing their insights on issues that affect you. Call in or email questions or comments to FedTalk@FederalNewsRadio.com. Fed Talk is sponsored by GEICO. This week, Bill Bransford will sit down for a roundtable discussion with several federal employee organizations to discuss the pay freeze, deficit commission recommendations, and what to expect when Congress returns in January.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight for December is the Capital Area Food Bank. When is the last time you went to bed hungry? Right here in the Washington metro area, over 200,000 children are going to bed hungry each night. Help the Capital Area Food Bank make this holiday season special for children in need. For every dollar you donate, the food bank can provide 3 meals. For more information, visit federalnewsradio.com. And remember, hunger never takes a holiday.
The Congressional Spotlight on Federal News Radio is presented by AT&T, investing in its network today to connect America's small businesses to the dreams of tomorrow. AT&T, your world delivered.
There is a watchmaking standard that is revered around the world. That standard comes from Rolex. From clasp to bracelet to its unique watertight oyster case, a Rolex holds its value because it was intended to. Crafted from just 3 precious metals, platinum, steel, and gold, each defies the ordinary. Its steel, 904L, virtually indestructible and corrosion-resistant, is incomparable. Its patented Everrose Gold, created in an exclusive foundry, will remain beautiful for life. Inside, a genuine Rolex movement is a product of superiority and remarkable testing. It is unrivaled. At Rolex, flawless standards create more than a watch. They create a value that was meant to endure. For a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Torno, the world's largest watch store since 1900. Torno, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
Government personnel must continue to achieve mission-critical objectives no matter their work environment. Video conferencing technologies provide a highly effective collaboration solution for federal employees affected by budget cuts, BRAC initiatives, and telework mandates if they are secure based on open standards and deployable in limited bandwidth environments. Polycom is the first video provider to have an ultimate HD portfolio that is JITC certified, offering real-time face-to-face communication without compromising secure networks or consuming excessive bandwidth. Polycom enables government customers to collaborate over voice and video anywhere, anytime, securely both inside and outside the firewall, offering high-definition video calls at half the bandwidth of other companies. To learn more, visit polycom.com/federal.
The Telework Center arms you with all the information you need to know about teleworking in the federal government. Go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Polycom.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news, now.
Looking for usable news and information that helps you do your job? Tune in to In Depth with Francis Rose every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Francis explores the relationship between agencies and Congress by taking you to the hearing rooms on Capitol Hill and asking questions of federal decision makers and experts. You'll get a firsthand look at how Congress affects your agency's personnel, funding, and oversight. In Depth also looks at the relationship between agencies and contractors, companies that do billions of dollars of business with the federal government, talk about the work they're doing for agencies, the work they're bidding on, and the work they didn't get. And In Depth will help you be a better manager. Francis talks to authors, scholars, and managerial experts about managing projects, managing your workforce, and managing yourself. In Depth with Francis Rose, every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hi, I'm Denise Ballou of the FBI. The case was revealed in December 1995. Operation Senior Sentinel targeted illegal boiler rooms and telemarketing fraud.
The case was hugely significant in that it's one of the few, if not only, instances I can think of where an entire crime problem was basically wiped out by very focused, dramatic investigation.
Keith Slaughter is special agent in charge of FBI San Diego. Formerly in Miami, he initiated the undercover operation that evolved into Senior Sentinel.
These were telemarketers who were really, really bad individuals who were promising big prizes and a lot of different things, preying on customers, especially the elderly.
Many were conned into losing their life savings, but the tables were turned.
Instead of using undercover agents in those cases, we used a combination of retired agents and retired citizens affiliated with the AARP to pose as victims.
Ultimately, about 1,200 arrests and hundreds of convictions. I'm Denise Ballou of the Bureau on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. Researchers have analyzed a survey on cyberbullying at schools and depression risk. Cyberbullying involves aggressive behaviors communicated over a computer or cell phone. Dr. Ronald Iannotti is with the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development.
With respect to symptoms of depression, victims of all forms of bullying, including cyberbullying, report more symptoms of depression. Even those who use all forms of bullying to bully others are at higher risk of depression.
Dr. Iannotti says because of the association between bullying and depression, bullies and victims are candidates for evaluation by a mental health professional. For details, visit www.nichd.nih.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Mike Causey on Federal News Radio.
I would rather give an ostrich a pedicure than play this.
Your turn with Mike Causey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. only on Federal News Radio. Check out Mike's column, The Federal Report, weekdays at federalnewsradio.com, or sign up to have Mike's daily column delivered directly to your email.
You know, they're probably going to find out in 20 years that carrying one of these in your wallet causes your buttocks to fall off.
Mike Causey on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA reporter Mallory Evans. Our guest on this edition of the program is Dr. Merve Kavakçe Islam, author of the just-released book Headscarf Politics in Turkey, a Post-Colonial Reading. Merve Kavakçe is a lecturer of international relations at George Washington University and at Howard University here in Washington, D.C. In her new book, Headscarf Politics, she writes a detailed study of Turkey's long tradition of secularism and includes her personal account of living as a female, devout Muslim politician who wears a headscarf. In 1999, Merve Kavakçe was elected to the Turkish parliament, but was not permitted to finish her term, in part because she refused to remove her headscarf. In Turkey, the Islamic headscarf is banned in public government spaces, including public schools, universities, and government offices. Dr. Kavakçe's Turkish citizenship was revoked, and she was banned from political participation in Turkey for 5 years. She took her case to the European Court of Justice in 2007 and won against Turkey. Her citizenship has since been reinstated. Since then, Dr. Kavakçe has shared her experiences with audiences around the world, in Europe, Canada, and across the United States. Dr. Merve Kavakçe Islam is recognized as one of the world's most influential 500 Muslims. And we'll talk with Dr. Kavakçe about her book and new political and social trends in Turkey, a rising power on the world stage. And Merve Kavakçe joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Indeed, Merve, and I want to remind our audience that you've been on our program before on Encounter, and we're delighted to have you as our sole newsmaker today.
Thank you.
And it is always a delight to welcome my colleague Mallory Evans.
Happy to be back.
Well, Merve, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
It's a great achievement. The topic is obviously both personal and political. Give us just a quick synopsis of your story, a very fascinating one, from the time you were removed from Parliament to your journey here to the United States and back again.
My journey to the United States actually has started early on in 1980s when I was a medical school student and I wasn't able to continue my education at Ankara University Medical School because I wear a hat scarf, and that is actually when my parents decided to take this very dramatic decision to move to another country where I and my two younger sisters could study without having to compromise on our religious values. And when I graduated here with a bachelor's of science degree in computer engineering, I went back, and then I had two children and got involved in politics, decided that one has to do as much as possible wherever they find their niche to pursue their aspirations to make a difference. And politics was my niche. And I worked for a political party for 7 years that actually I volunteered. And then found myself as the first woman to be elected to the Turkish parliament with a headscarf. However, I was prevented from taking my oath of office and stripped from my citizenship and therefore ousted from the parliamentary activities. And the party that I was representing was closed down by the constitutional court with the premise that it was antithetical to the secular state edifice of Turkish Republic. And my colleagues actually at the time established a new party which is now ruled Turkey for the past 8 years. Since then, I thought that after Ankara politics, Washington was the next best place to be active, and I reside in Washington, D.C. for the past 10 years, and here I not only am activist, but also I'm an academic. The book that we're talking about today is a product of my doctoral dissertation.
Merve, I want to pick up on the fact that, as you said, the AK Party, which has Islamist roots, is now in power, so it's a different political scenario than when you were in politics and were removed from parliament. But let me go back to what some devil's advocates or critics would say about your view. They say that in Turkey, freedom of religion is protected under the constitution, that it's a constitution that enshrines secularism as one of its basic principles, and that in the Turkish context, secularism is understood as the government being neutral in terms of religion. And that's partly why public employees, those working in the government-run universities, in the public schools, in the parliament, should not wear visible signs of their religion, such as a headscarf. So what is wrong with that interpretation, and therefore not allowing female politicians who do wear the headscarf to wear it at least during, you know, the parliament, but certainly everywhere else they go, at home or in the streets and so forth.
There are two flaws with the statements you are suggesting. Yes, the Constitution of Turkey renders freedom of expression and religion to its citizens. However, the international organization reports like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and United States State Department Human Rights Reports, as well as United Nations and some of the commissions at the European Union, clearly depict that there is a chasm, dichotomy between what is stated in the Constitution, what is implemented on the ground, and that the headscarf ban is an abridgment of human rights for women. Secondly, Turkish secularism is different than the separation of church and state as we understand United States of America, where two of these entities can flourish on their own and the state has an equal distance to all religions so that all religious expressions could burgeon in their own pace and track. In the context of Turkey, secularism, the separation of church and state, is understood as religion cannot interfere with the state affairs, but the state has an upper hand over religion and has the right to not only control religion, but also shape religion's role in public space, as well as, at times, the private space as well. So Turkish secularism would be much closer to the French laïcité. However, you have to turn it a notch up, because the French laïcité even lets some sort of free space for people to operate if they do want to exercise their religious freedom. That is to say, in universities, the headscarf is not banned, or in public space, the headscarf is not banned in France. And I acknowledge the fact that there are discriminations throughout the world against many peoples from different walks of life, but at least in the Constitution and in the legal system, there is that leeway out for people who want to practice their religious expression.
Is there a groundswell among devout Muslim women who do prefer to wear the headscarf to get this ban overturned in Turkey? What does the polling data say about, you know, the desire for this greater freedom of using the headscarf in government buildings and universities?
Indeed, there is a very prevalent general consensus that is not just supported by the women with headscarves, but the larger population in Turkey, that a woman with a headscarf should be able to wear it if she decides to run for parliament. Over 60% of the Turkish people concur that a female parliamentarian should be able to wear a headscarf. Almost 90% of the Turkish people concur that women with headscarves should be allowed to have an education, higher education. So there's no problem on the ground. We come from a very multicultural, diverse, and pluralistic historical background, and we are able to pass their differences. However, we have a problem at the upper levels of the state echelon, very much so supported by the militaristic view in Turkey that the headscarf is a symbol of the backwardness that is very much affiliated with our Islamic tradition, unfortunately.
But now that the AK Party is the ruling party, which has Islamist roots, which is more sympathetic perhaps to your view and others who think that the headscarf should be allowed in government buildings and public universities, do you see a change in the offing? Do you think legislation will be passed? I mean, what's your sense, because you have a more sympathetic government?
Well, AK Party has been in power in the past 8 years, and only the women with headscarves were the left out, disenfranchised group who did not really have their voices heard by AK Party and had to wait basically for the second term of their coming to power after 2007, and now we're in 2010, so we have been waiting for the past 8 years, and very recently the Supreme Education Council has sent a letter to universities stating that no student will be forced out of the classroom because they do wear a headscarf. The only requirement is that the professor needs to take an investigation note and put it in record that the student is sitting in the classroom with a headscarf. So the problem has not been resolved involved, because at some universities, the presidents of universities or deans or particular professors are denying students from coming into their classroom. And we have a gap between the rule of law and its implementation in a rapidly democratizing, yet a country that has not completed its democratization processes. Therefore, we have this gap right there, that when an order comes in, sometimes we have problems.
We'll have more in a minute, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Dr. Merve Cavacce-Islam. She's a lecturer of international relations at George Washington University and former member of the Turkish Parliament. She's the author of the recently published book, Headscarf Politics in Turkey. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA reporter Mallory Evans, and this is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available online as a podcast. Please visit our website, voanews.com, and click on podcasts. And now a question for Mallory.
Merve, your book was written with Western readers in mind. In the West, some see Muslim veils as a form of oppression, and headscarves are the subject of your book. So would you mind sharing with our listeners why you choose to wear a head covering and why you think this decision is so divisive?
I wear my headscarf out of my loyalty to God. And the headscarf, the covering of women, is not exceptional to Muslim women. I believe in one message from one God, the message that was revealed to Moses or Jesus, peace be upon both of them, mandated that women do cover themselves. And therefore, that's why we have Jewish women, Christian women, and Muslim women who do cover, and Jewish women, Christian women, and Muslim women who do not cover as well. But personally, I believe that Muslim women must cover herself. That's the way I understand. That's the way I choose my life to pursue. And that's why I do wear my headscarf. It's part of my identity, who I am. However, indeed, it is divisive, and I go through the Orientalist readings in this very book and try to deconstruct the Orientalist assumptions about Muslim women and her appearance. Muslim women has been perceived as a foreign object. She looks different, and she's at a distance to the Occidental person. And therefore, there is a consensus, almost a very wide range of writing on Muslim women by the Orientalists, arguing that the wearing of the headscarf and her covering is a sign of oppression over women. However, while I acknowledge the fact that some women might be adopting the headscarf and other religious symbols out of coercion, out of peer pressure, there is a large number of women throughout the world who wear their headscarves and they feel very much empowered. And they are not oppressed. I am one of those women. Nobody is forcing me to do what I'm doing and to dress in the way that I am dressing, and I feel very much empowered. My focus in this very book is these women, the Muslim women who enjoy the citizenship rights of the nation states they live under, as well as insistently adopting the headscarf. They have a claim in public space, and they have a claim for their religiosity. Where do we put this increasing number of women throughout the world? So I try to bring their perspective to the story.
You spoke earlier of the State Department reports and other reports that said that parts of the Turkish constitution actually restrict religious freedom in order to protect secularism. And I was wondering, have you noticed or seen any religious freedoms restricted in people of other faiths? I know that Turkey is a majority Muslim country, but there are Christians and Jews and people of other faiths there, and does it also infringe on any of their rights?
The Constitution actually gives all rights to all citizens in an equal manner, but the way we construe our constitutional rights through the lens of secularism, that is Turkish secularism, which is different than the way we understand secularism in larger part of Europe and United States of America, basically precludes the practices of various religious rites. So when you read the Constitution, you will not see much of a problem there, but there is a problem in the way we understand our constitutional rights. The reports indeed make references to other minorities as well. Yes, Turkey is a 99% Muslim country, and it's a secular country. It's a country that has somehow reconciled between its secular state edifice and Islamic heritage. heritage. And we have a minority of Jews and Christians and other denominations in the country as well. And the reports, international reports, including one of the reports that is prepared by State Department, make a reference to the human rights violations carried out and religious freedom violations carried out against these two groups and other denominations as well. Not only them, but the majority of the women population. 70% of the women of Turkey wear headscarves, the statistics tell us today. That majority is also prevented from exercising their very fundamental right of equal opportunity to education and equal opportunity to work and religious freedom as well. So it's not a majority-minority issue. Different groups are fortunately at the target.
Dr. Kovacic, I wanted to turn this question on its head a little bit. Let's talk about the AK Party and the new orientation of Turkey toward its Arab neighbors, and because it's always been considered a bridge between the East and the West. Its secular tradition has always been of comfort in the sense that, yes, it's a majority Muslim nation, respecting those who are more devout, but at the same time has this very secular orientation to perhaps inhibit any kind of radical Islamic elements. But there are increasing reports, maybe anecdotal nonetheless, that show that their Islamic religiosity is on the rise. More mosques are being built. There's a restriction on alcohol being sold in some stores. And some see these trends as a cause for concern in the other direction, that actually the secular Turks are feeling intimidated under pressure. Maybe some women who choose not to wear the headscarf are feeling like they should wear the headscarf because the president's wife wears a headscarf, the foreign minister's wife wears a headscarf, a number of ministers' wives, and they're feeling actually pressure, you know, in the reverse. So how do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, there are two issues here. One is the changing Turkish foreign policy with this new adoption of the zero problems with neighbors, where Turkey is in a way rising as a mediator, a strong power holder in the region, and therefore reconciling and ameliorating its relationship with its Middle Eastern neighbors, as well as continuing its relationship with European Union. Let's first put the context right. This is a party, AK Party, and under AK Party, which has its Islamist roots and has some practicing Muslims in its executive offices, is one party that has carried Turkey to the European accession process closer, much closer than another party. This is one party that had made much more strides that will near us to the process of European Union accession, much more than another so-called secular government has
ever done.
This
is a very important point.
That's a very important point. And there, they deconstructed many of the assumptions about them and some of the caveats and maybe reservations about them when they came to power in 2002. Now, coming back to the rising religiosity in Turkey, well, religion is in the rise across the globe. This is not a particular issue, matter, new development that is exceptional to Turkey.
Except that it's exceptional, one could argue, because of the very secular tradition that Turkey has endured,
indeed,
you know, for the past decades.
What we need to understand from Washington, D.C., and from the West of the West, United States of America, is that the secularism that we hailed and praised within the context of Turkey as this role model Muslim state was very oppressive to start with. Or at least it turned out to be very oppressive and very meddlesome and very prying into private realm over the decades, to the extent that it became an impediment in the path of the democratization processes. Seculars are not the ones who have concern about religious freedom and the lifting of the headscarf ban. It is the Kemalist elite, whom I dub, from the American context, secular fundamentalists. They're not seculars. They are secular fundamentalists who do not have the ability to tolerate anybody who do not appear like them, who do not think like them, or who do not dress like them. That is the only concern that we have and one stumbling block in the democratization processes. Indeed, there might be exceptional cases of pressures from religious groups over other groups who do not want to practice religious values. However, currently what we're talking about in this book is the kind of systematic, orchestrated, state-orchestrated violation of human rights and rights to education and employment.
Indeed. Let me just state that when you say Kemalist, of course we're referring to Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the modern Turkish state.
I'm referring to the group who are inspired by him, who wield him, who use him as a semi-divine figure,
yes.
And who use his policies to be sacred. That is not up for discussion.
Okay, now back to one more question with respect to those who perhaps feel themselves a little bit under pressure or feel intimidated by the rising religiosity of the AK Party and so on. For example, we're witnessing a strain in bilateral relations between Turkey and Israel, and the Jews have always found haven in Turkey since the Inquisition. Mm-hmm. Jews have been welcomed in Turkey and have found a haven there. However, of late we're seeing more anti-Semitic incidents of anti-Semitism, whether that's related to the strain in relations with Israel or other reasons. Is that of concern to you, and is that a legitimate criticism?
I'm not sure I have followed the rising numbers in data over anti-Semitism. Jewish and Christian population has been part of the Turkish tapestry for centuries, as you had explained. And the relationship between Turkish Republic and Israel was basically based on, and today it is still based on, our military alliance. It is very interesting to note that as a politician and as a political scientist, Turks might be divided on a variety of issues, but when it comes to the issue of Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you find almost all Turks united on the camp of pro-Palestinians. And therefore, what is happening in Israel had gotten quite a bit of reaction by the Turkish Republic, as well as the Turkish people on the ground. And Turkish people, I would argue, are smart enough to differentiate between the actions of a state, that is the state of Israel, and the Jewish people who live in their land as well. But if there is any kind of animosity, one has to acknowledge that. I find AK Party to be very staunch about trying to eliminate any kind of discrimination against any minority in this case, but there will be always exceptions here and there.
We've been talking a lot about the differences between Turkey's secularism and the separation of church and state in the United States. And you've lived in the U.S. for years, and you've said that you've always felt respected in the United States. I was wondering if you have experienced any different feelings as of late. I know there have been a lot of examples of intolerance in the news recently. Do you still think that America is a great place to live as a Muslim?
I still think so. I write on this as well. I think United States democracy is one of a kind. It is the kind of democracy that needs to be implemented, that needs to be carried out throughout the world. However, the change must come from within, through the hand of the indigenous people on the ground. We must not export democratization to the rest of the world, because it becomes very deterrent and repelling, if you will, when a foreign person brings in the package of democratization. The kind of democracy that I find to be very valuable in the United States has to do with the institutionalization of the democratic values. Yes, here and there we have exceptions, and from time to time there are discriminations against various groups, including Muslims. I personally have been very fortunate not to experience any kind of such attacks, but I had friends who had gone through very difficult times as well. However, what I find in the United States to be very fascinating is that the institutionalization of these democratic values are so strongly rooted in our system that there's always a higher authority that you can appeal your case. And when we deviate as the American people from the democratic values at times due to the concerns about security or other things, we always find a way to bounce back and come to normal. So I find these deviations to be ephemeral and aberrations from the norm of the American institutions of democracy. The institutions of democracy in other lands, including Turkey, are not very well rooted in the sense that we find it in the United States. So I'm able to compare and contrast and very honestly say very clearly that I cannot take for granted the rights that we enjoy in this very country.
And Merve Kavakci, let's close by talking about your native Turkey, particularly the status of women. Are you optimistic that women will continue to enjoy human rights, progress both politically and economically?
In a nutshell, the rising religiosity is not the reason why women are not empowered in the way that they are supposed to be in Turkey. State patriarchy is the major reason why women are not empowered in Turkey. Despite the fact that they might be wearing a headscarf or they may not be wearing a headscarf, some of the actions taken against Turkish women's empowerment are not taken by the religious authorities or Islamist parties. They're very much taken by the very real secular, patriarchal sort of Republican parties, unfortunately. So I see hope so long as women can join hands together and try to make a difference to increase their place in public sphere.
The book is Headscarf Politics in Turkey, and the author, Dr. Merve Kavakci İslam, Lecturer of International Relations and former member of the Turkish Parliament. Merve, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your insights, and congratulations on the publication of your book.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Skip Sisk. And joining me on the program was VOA reporter Mallory Evans. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is David
Starting
Gregory. Join me Sundays at 8 p.m.
And a lot of monitors
for Meet
News Radio, 1500 AM. Cyber
That's right, the same great show
you in Maryland. They'll give watchstanders the ability to see cyber attacks as they happen and respond to them. Vice Admiral Barry McCullough is the commander of Navy's Fleet Cyber Command. He tells Federal News Radio,
"It's built around the way the Navy does command and control at the operational level of war. So it has various displays and information feeds that our operators can view in real time and make decisions to better operate and defend a network."
For the operators that work there, it'll be a big improvement.
"Right now, my Maritime Operations Center is in a 6x6 room. It houses two watchstanders, and so we call it mock in a box. So we're moving from mock in a box to a real maritime operations center."
But it's not just about extra elbow room for sailors on the watch floor. McCullough says none of the armed services have the ability to take a proactive, real-time view of the information pipelines they've come to rely on so heavily.
"Right now, we're all in a reactive mode. We find somebody in our network, we figure out what it is, we figure out how to stop it, and then how to clean it, and we go on. And that can take hours to months. And in a cyber war, you can't react in hours to months. Most of the time, you have to react at machine speed, and at worst, you have to react in near real time, which is minutes time latency. We don't have that today."
McCullough says they'll have it about 60% operational this week, 85% by March. But he says it's a fact of life that they'll never reach 100% because the tools they need to develop situational awareness, or SA, will keep on evolving.
"And we're going to have people watching television. because we don't know how to integrate the data that's available coming off the network and make it a current operational picture for cyber. You need that to have dynamic SA. If you don't have dynamic SA, you can't do dynamic defense.
Each of the armed services are still in the very early stages of developing their cyber commands as components of the Defense Department's overall U.S. Cyber Command. The Navy and the Air Force are the furthest along, and they only declared themselves at full operational capability in October. But Nicola says creating network visibility and figuring out how the various pieces of the cyber command puzzle will work together is a top priority.
So this is something we've got to continue to press, because when this war goes hot, we're not going to have 2 or 3 months to sort this out. And why do I say that? The bad guys are inside the wire, and the dot mil networks suffer about 250,000 attack attempts a day.
But McCullough says there are plenty of things the military, and the Navy in particular, are doing well in the cyber warfare arena.
The Navy has the premier electronic attack capability in the U.S. military.
Via the electronic warfare platforms on their EA-18 Growler jets. He says they've also done well in setting up cyber warfare capabilities on their surface ships and with overall information operations. McCullough says his next big challenge is getting his new command staffed. He says he thinks he's about 1,600 people short of what he needs to perform the missions he's been given by U.S. Cyber Command, and most of those positions need to be filled by people who are highly trained in cybersecurity.
If you bought those people, that's almost $600 million. We don't have $600 million. And so we've got to find the resources from within. It's a zero-sum game.
And making it harder to find those resources from within, the Navy's emphasis on making sure its uniformed personnel serve time at sea, taking them away from cyber.
And I was one of those guys that 18 months ago would have told you every sailor needs to go to sea or shouldn't be in the Navy. And so then they send me up to Fort Meade into an environment and a domain that I know absolutely nothing about. And we start to have this discussion about how much training investment and thus money you put into a young man or woman to qualify them to do what we need them to do. And we usually leave them there for about 3 to 4 years, and then we were sending them to sea. And you have to maintain proficiency in this business, or you go back to zero and have to start all the training all over again. So now if the Navy really wants to operate in this environment and in this warfare domain, do we maintain our standard career path?
McCullough says no, that the Navy needs to create a career path that's focused intently on cybersecurity. But in the short term, he says he's exploring other routes to fill those jobs, possibly including direct hires at the GS-15 level or uniform members of the reserves. In Washington, Jared Serbu, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Cutting your risk of a stroke. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Each year, almost 800,000 Americans have a stroke. Strokes are the third leading cause of death and one of the leading causes of disability. But people can reduce their risk of stroke. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Mary George says these steps include not smoking, not drinking a lot, keeping weight and eating patterns healthy, and being physically active. She also says,
more than 3 out of every 4 people that have a stroke have a history of high blood pressure. It's very important that people have their blood pressure checked, and if they have high blood pressure, it's important to talk to their doctor about steps to control their blood pressure.
An article highlighting the danger of stroke was in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Profile America, Wednesday, December 15th. One of the most notable films in U.S. movie history opened on this date in 1939 in Atlanta, Georgia, Gone with the Wind, based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the Civil War by Margaret Mitchell. The movie, starring Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh, was a huge success, winning a then-unprecedented 8 Academy Awards. The publicity surrounding the premiere was such that 300,000 people braved the cold to watch the stars arrive at Lowe's Grand Theater, and the governor of Georgia proclaimed a state holiday in honor of the event. In 1939, there were more than 15,000 movie theaters across the U.S. Today, that figure is just under 5,000. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington, the Washington, D.C.